Imagine if you didn't have the ability to form new memories. What would your life be like? Think about it. You'd be stuck in a permanent present tense. That's what happened to Henry Molaison. He started life as a normal, healthy boy, but in 1953, when he was 27, he underwent a targeted lobotomy to control his epilepsy. The operation had an unexpected and devastating consequence. It robbed him of his ability to form new memories. And so Henry lived with amnesia until his death at the age of 82.
So a pressing question is, did Henry Molaison possess a sense of self? The answer is, yes, he did. But it was less complete than ours.
Suzanne Corkin spent nearly 5 decades working with Henry Molaison, and she's written a book about him and what his case contributed to brain science and our understanding of memory. It's called Permanent Present Tense, The Unforgettable Life of the Amnesic Patient HM. Suzanne Corkin is a professor emerita of neuroscience and head of the Corkin Lab at MIT. You first met him in 1962 as a graduate student at McGill. Can you tell me something about that first meeting, what it was like to meet him?
Henry and his mother came to the neuro for a week so Henry could be tested. Each time I went to test him, I would introduce myself because he didn't know who I was. He was a very cooperative research participant. He was above average intelligence. His IQ was 112. Now, if it were a memory task, he didn't do so well. But, of course, we tested him on other kinds of measures as well, like vocabulary. His vocabulary was very good. He could do mental arithmetic. Now, one of the tests that I tested him on was a tactual stylus maze. So I tried to teach him to find the correct route from the start of this maze to the finish of this maze without going into any blind alleys. I gave him the instructions every time, of course. And he did this actually for 80 trials during the week that he was there. And during that time, his errors did not decrease at all. He didn't learn the declarative aspect of the task. He couldn't consciously recollect the route. But because that kind of learning, declarative memory, depends on the structures that were removed from his brain, that experiment also had a very surprising and wonderful finding. During the time that he was unable to learn the correct turns, he did learn the task. He learned the procedure of going from the start to the finish.
You mentioned declarative memory, which was impaired in Henry's case, and that that's opposed to non-declarative memory, which was largely preserved. Can you just explain those two kinds of memory, what that means?
So declarative memory is your conscious recollection of facts and events. So if I ask you to tell me what you had for dinner last night and what the whole dining experience was like, I would be testing your memory for that event, and you would remember that. But Henry could not record any new events or any new facts. He couldn't learn any new vocabulary. In contrast, non-declarative memory is sort of everything else.
So in his case, he lost that declarative memory, but he had non-declarative memory. So what did he actually remember? I mean, what could he remember?
He could learn new motor skills. He could show classical conditioning. He could show perceptual learning. But the way this manifested itself in everyday life was striking. Over the years, he developed osteoporosis. And so, of course, the people in his nursing home were worried about his falling. They gave him a walker. Now, if you've never used a walker, you may not know that there are a set of motor skills that you need to acquire to use the walker properly. And he learned all of these skills without conscious awareness. He learned how to use the walker very efficiently, but he had no idea why he was using it. So when I asked him, well, why do you have the walker? He just said, so I won't fall down. He didn't have the declarative knowledge that I have osteoporosis and I'm getting fractures and I don't want to get any more. He had none of this declarative knowledge, but he knew the procedure.
I'm curious that you worked with him for 46 years. That's almost a half a century. Did he start to recognize you at all the more you worked with him?
So he never really knew who I was, but beginning around the 1980s, he'd say that he knew me from high school. Now, why did he think that? Over the years, he built up a sense of familiarity for my face and my name. And as a result of this constant exposure, he believed that he knew me. And this feeling likely became stronger as the years went by. So when I first met him in '62, he didn't say he knew me from high school. But roughly 20 years later, you know, after a lot of exposure, he started saying that he recognized me.
Mm, it's so fascinating. In your book, you quote Cicero, actually. You write, and he said, memory is the treasury and guardian of all things. So I'm curious, to what extent is memory inextricably linked to identity? Because it really seems to be, as you describe Henry's case.
Our notion of self is a composite of our memories from the past and present and our plans for the future. And when we examine Henry's access to these different time periods, we find that it was patchy. He had rich mental representations covering the period from his birth, 1926, up to August 53, the date of the experimental brain operation that rendered him amnesic. But the quality of these preoperative memories was severely compromised.
Now, what did Henry's case teach us about how memory works?
His case launched the modern era of memory research. First of all, he was living proof that you can be an intelligent person and still have a horrible memory.
Hmm.
And this tells us that memory is processed by specialized brain circuits, not the whole brain working at once, but specialized circuits. Memory is compartmentalized. And the second important finding is that he showed us that the ability to form new memories is localized to a specific part of the brain, namely the inner part of the temporal lobes, the hippocampus and surrounding cortex. Before Henry, we didn't understand that this hippocampal area was essential for the establishment of long-term memory, and he clinched this association between medial temporal lobe structures and amnesia.
Hmm.
And then the third contribution was the discovery, something we just talked about before, that there are different kinds of memory with different addresses in the brain.
To what extent was Henry aware of his condition, or to what extent did he understand what was wrong with him? Was he able to articulate anything about his memory that was not right?
He had excellent insight. He knew that he had epilepsy, so he knew this from before his operation. He knew that he had an operation, and he said an operation on his head. He never said his brain. And he had the sense that something didn't go quite right. He knew that it had been done on only a few people before him and that maybe somebody messed up in his operation.
Hmm.
He definitely knew that he had a memory impairment. And he didn't try to make up answers if you asked him something and he didn't know the answer. So, you know, if I said to him, well, what did you have for lunch today? He wouldn't make up, you know, I had a BLT and chocolate pudding and tea. He would just say, you know, I don't remember that. He confronted his memory impairment, and he accepted it, and he dealt with it.
There was something really revealing in your book that I loved. It was in the introduction about an exchange between you and Henry, and you ask him the question, what do you think you'll do tomorrow? And his answer is, whatever's beneficial. So did he understand that his case was somehow helping science, that it was beneficial in some way?
I think in some sense he did. And I think it was a source of great comfort and satisfaction to him during the rest of his life.
Mm.
But when it came to looking into the future, he was at a loss. He couldn't construct an agenda.
Fascinating.
And he was never able to chase his dreams because he didn't have any.
Wow. Your book goes so deeply into what Henry's case teaches us. It's also a story of a very personal story of a human being. I mean, what Henry was like as a person. And I'm wondering if you could talk a little bit about that. I mean, that was your purpose as well in writing this book, wasn't it? To really describe a...
Absolutely.
A human
Absolutely.
Being.
Absolutely. You know, there was a real person behind the initials HM. And a real person behind all of the data that we published in scientific journals. He was a really gentle person. He was intelligent. He was very friendly. And he was altruistic. When I was writing the book, I had the opportunity to talk with some people who knew him in high school. And they all said exactly the same thing about him. It was like a recording I heard over and over. They said he was quiet. He kept to himself. And he was very polite.
Hmm. Well, that's Suzanne Corkin describing H.M., who was Henry Molaison. And Suzanne Corkin, thank you so much for talking to us. We really appreciate it.
Thank you, Anthony. It was a pleasure.
Suzanne Corkin is a professor emerita of neuroscience and head of the Corkin Lab at MIT. Her new book is called Permanent Present Tense, The Unforgettable Life of the Amnesic Patient HM. There's more information and an excerpt from the book at radioboston.org.
Stay with us. Coming up, Damien Eccles of the so-called West Memphis Three on his life after spending 18 years on death row. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
And I'm Anthony Brooks. This is Radio Boston.